We get things underway by talking with music journalist, contributing editor to Rolling Stone, the author of several books, including Turnaround, Bright Eyes, Love is a Mixtape, which I still cry like a baby every time I read it, and his newest, which is absolutely wonderful, Dreaming the Beatles. Rob Sheffield, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, good to meet you, man. Thanks for talking today.
Oh, well, love to. And man, the book was so good. And I wanted to kick it off with Dear Prudence, because that's a key part of the book. And the fact that you have a theory, and I think it's a pretty good one, that everything John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote was based primarily on, as you put it, looking for the right girl, looking for any girl to sing to.
Yeah, it's so funny that they met when they were, you know, 15, 16-year-old boys, very young. They're the only songwriters in their town. They've been through this really private heartbreak they have in common. And it's amazing that from the beginning, they communicate to each other, this incredibly deep and complex friendship, and they communicate to each other by writing songs about girls. That's all they want to do.
Now, and you say this in the book as well, in the preface to it, and look, I'm a big Beatles guy. I read so many of the Beatles books that come out. Why another Beatles book? But that's answered pretty early. You've got a very fresh take and a different perspective on the Beatles. And one of the things I like is that it's not a primer on the Beatles. You assume that the reader's got a certain level of knowledge going in.
Well, yeah, there's the basic story that we all know and love, and that's really why I wanted to write this book, was a book that's not just retelling the story of the Beatles in the 60s, but I really wanted to look at the Beatles of the 80s and the Beatles of the 70s and the Beatles of the 90s and the Beatles of today. I mean, the really strange thing about the Beatles, in many ways the strangest thing, is that they're still the most popular band in the world now, and that they're more popular now than they were when they broke up nearly 50 years ago.
Yeah, and I love something you write in the book is that our Beatles have outlasted theirs.
Yeah, it's really funny when you see little kids listen to the Beatles for the first time and you see them freak out, and they come to it with no baggage and no preconceptions about what they're supposed to like, but they just hear it, and there's something elemental in the sound of these voices and the songs that just almost has an instantaneous rush.
Their album one, their collection of number one songs, the best-selling album of the 21st century, even though, as you point out, probably everybody who bought it had several copies of those songs already. And these guys, they're not, certainly not of their own time anymore. Timeless, I guess, is the word for it.
Absolutely timeless. And it's funny now that, you know, that their new version of Sgt. Pepper just debuted at the top of the charts, which is really crazy when you think of it. This album that's been incredibly famous already for 50 years. I mean, it's not like anybody didn't know about Sgt. Pepper and is just hearing about it for the first time this week. But something about the allure of this music, we always hear new things in it, and we always want to hear new things in it.
Everybody's Beatles story is different, and you explain that yours begins with the movie Help. Can you tell that story a little bit?
Yeah, I was a little kid in the 70s, and I was watching the movie Help on TV, and I don't know what you think about Help. I still love that movie. It's the silliest Beatles movie. And the Beatles themselves, they made fun of it because they thought it was just kind of a cartoonish kiddie movie. But I saw that on Channel 56 in Boston when I was a little kid in the 70s. And I was watching it. I'm sitting there with my grandmother and watching it, the opening scene. You see the Beatles singing the song Help. And it's just the four of them and their turtlenecks and their guitars. And they're singing this incredibly emotional song that's got a lot of sad lyrics, but yet there's something happy about hearing those voices spilling out together. And it just really fried my brain. And I just thought, wow, this is what adulthood is like. This is what having friends is like. This is what music is like. Sign me up for all of this.
You mentioned, too, you listen to albums at the Milton Public Library. Now, off the Beatles for a moment here, because I'm wondering if we had the same experience where we're of a similar age. You mentioned that you were perusing some album covers. You mentioned Linda Ronstadt. And so I'm assuming, like me, you had a great affection for the cover of her Hasten Down the Wind album.
I think that's my favorite. I mean, it's hard to pick favorite Linda Ronstadt album covers, but it's hard to top that one.
Yeah, if you're a little younger, maybe it's her with the roller skating gear on.
I love that one, too. But yeah, and it's funny that it was sort of a golden age of Linda Ronstadt album cover.
No question about that. We're talking with Rob Sheffield, author of Dreaming the Beatles. You make some bold statements in the book. I love them all, including this one that's hard to argue with. You say that you believe I Saw Her Standing There is the best first song on a debut album ever.
Yeah, it's amazing how many bands have done that thing that the Beatles did, of where you're putting out your first album and you make the first song on it a real mission statement. And, you know, if the only thing you knew of the Beatles is hearing the first song on their first record, I Saw Her Standing There, you would still have a pretty good idea of just how aggressive they were, how inventive they were, how ambitious they were, just how enthusiastic they were. And it's funny that, you know, there's so many other contenders for that crowd. I mean, Guns N' Roses, Welcome to the Jungle, the first song on Appetite for Destruction, is pretty great. And NWA, Straight Outta Compton, the first song on their debut album, it's pretty great. But for my money, I Saw Her Standing There, it tops them all. It's a mission statement right from the beginning.
And as you mentioned, too, the Beatles, as they grew and they progressed, the songs got more complicated and dealt with weightier issues, although often about girls, later on about women. But I loved you talking about the fact that you were hearing about adult relationships and learning about them in many ways from these four guys.
Yeah, long before I ever had one in real life. I remember hearing that song when I was a little kid in the 70s. I had the Blue album. Do you remember the Blue album?
I do. The Blue and the Red album, yeah.
Yeah, those were formative for me. And there's this great song on the Blue album. It was never a hit, but I've always been so glad this song was on the album. Very late song from the Let It Be sessions, Don't Let Me Down. And just this incredibly beautiful and, you know, a very adult-sounding song. And I remember hearing this, you know, and I'm a little kid, and I'm thinking, this is really strange to hear this adult man singing about, you know, being in love with this woman. And he's not singing in a teen romance kind of way. He's singing about adult love, where he's afraid of, you know, where it might go, and has his hopes up for where it might go. And just that beautiful kind of sentiment that it's not a sad song, but it's a serious song. And it, songs like that really changed the way I thought about the world.
With the re-release of Sgt. Pepper and all the recognition of that, the talk comes back again about it being the greatest album of all time. And that's certainly a very subjective thing. Revolver gets a lot of mention, Rubber Soul. For you, I think I'm correct on this, you believe that Revolver's the better album, but you like Rubber Soul better.
Yeah, that's just a personal favorite. It's the emotional favorite for me. Rubber Soul is the one with the best singing. If what you're mainly into is hearing the Beatles sing together, their best singing is on Rubber Soul. And something I love is that Paul's backup vocals on John's songs, that John's backup vocals on Paul's songs, everybody is singing at the top of their game. And Rubber Soul has the funniest songs and the saddest songs. And yeah, I just love that one to pieces. And I can recognize, you know, my conscience informs me that, yeah, Revolver is probably a greater artistic achievement, and so is the White Album. But, you know, when push comes to shove, if I could only listen to one for the rest of my life, it'd be Rubber Soul. I mean, if you catch me in the right mood, I'll even defend Michelle. I love that song.
Well, and Rubber Soul maybe contains songs about the most complicated women you'll hear about in Beatles songs.
Yeah, it's really funny that when, you know, I was 8 years old or 9 years old and hearing Norwegian Wood for the first time, and I thought, well, this is very mysterious. What an interesting kind of woman in this song. And something I love is that, you know, John, who I'm listening to it, and he's the grown-up in the song, and he's as confused by this woman as I am. He's like, yeah, I don't know what she meant when she said to sit down and she didn't have a chair. And the girl is so confident and so poised, and he's just stumbling and stammering and feeling foolish. And there's something really beautiful about those songs on Rubber Soul, and amazing to think that they were written by such young guys.
We're talking with Rob Sheffield. His book is entitled Dreaming the Beatles. And I love the latter chapters of the book when you talk about the guys individually. And Ringo comes across as, I guess, what in sports we would call the glue guy. He's the one who can he can keep everybody together. He can handle the big personalities, and everybody else in the band loves him.
Absolutely. And you know, you think about people say, you know, Ringo was a good drummer or he wasn't good enough to be in the Beatles. I think he was a great drummer. But even more than that, he was somebody who, like you said, was the glue guy for the others. And you know, they loved being around him, and they knew that as long as Ringo was playing drums, things were going to turn out well. So just the impact he had on the rest of them. There's a great moment I love. We were talking a minute ago about the song Don't Let Me Down. And there's a great version of that song in the Get Back sessions where, you know, John is doing the song with the rest of the band, and he says to Ringo to give him a big smash on the cymbals before the song starts. And he says, you know, give me a big shh on the cymbal. Give me the courage to come screaming in. I just love that. That's that really kind of sums up, you know, John was able to sing such a raw and open and honest song because he knew that Ringo would be there giving him the courage to come screaming in.
George comes across, as he always does, as a very interesting, a very conflicted guy. George is your wife's favorite Beatle, is that right?
Yeah, she is madly in love with George.
And you say that, and either you're right here, he wrote great songs about hating being a Beatle.
It's really strange when you think of how fast George soured on being a Beatle, and that, you know, it's only like 1966. He hasn't been a Beatle very long, but he said, I'm putting my foot down. I'm never touring again. This is done. And the other Beatles were at least open to the idea. George was the one who insisted that they just never tour again. And when you think of the songs that he wrote about being a Beatle, like Blue Jay Way, which is a song I love on the Magical Mystery Tour record. And it's really funny that this is a song by a guy who's really sick of being a Beatle. And he's like, please, I've been here too long. Let me out of here. And there's something really beautiful about that.
And yet, late in his solo career, he was certainly not above using that Beatle notoriety.
Yeah, he, you know, like the other four Beatles, they all had moments in their post-Beatle life where they felt, okay, we're adults now, we're in control of our lives, we're independent. We really wish the world would move on and let us move on with our lives. And for some reason, that they were still drawn back to this adolescent friendship that they had, and that the rest of the world was still drawn to that friendship, was something that for all of them at different moments was just very perplexing. I mean, for you or me, to think about the people that, you know, you're friends with when you're 16 or 17, and then think about being chained to those people for life, it is really kind of a scary idea.
So is the world divided into people who are either Pauls or Johns?
I think so. I mean, most of us are a little of both, but it's funny that in any kind of friendship, there's the one who's responsible and takes care of things and makes the restaurant reservation and makes sure that the car is filled with gas and, you know, takes care of business. And then there's the other one who's more impulsive and more spontaneous and just more freewheeling. And it's funny that in any relationship, you kind of automatically know whether you're the John or you're the Paul.
Well, and I love you. You talk about late in their career when John and Yoko went out and recorded Two Virgins. After they've dumped on Paul, but they need somebody to write the foreword for the album, and they go to Paul. And then when John's off on his last weekend, who does Yoko dispatch to bring him back but Paul? He's the guy who was always there for everybody. And yet, as you point out, he's the only Beatle that people seem to hate.
Yeah, it's really funny to me over the course of the years of being a Beatle fan that, you know, people, for better or worse, people will argue about Ringo and people will argue about George and people will argue about John. But for the most part, people are really kind of settled in those Beatles as they're in their roles. And Paul is the one that people just differ really wildly about. Some people just love Paul. Some people just hate Paul, which sounds crazy to me. But it's funny that for me, as a, you know, got to be honest, I'm a pro-Paul partisan. I'm strongly pro-Paul. And it's funny for me in talking about the Beatles how much Paul is really the one that people violently disagree about.
Yeah, and you talk about seeing him in concert, and I had a similar experience seeing him at Fenway a few years back. And the thought was, 3 hours in, why is this guy working so hard?
Yeah, exactly. He could phone it in, and he just doesn't. I mean, I'm still sad I missed that Fenway show. That's a sore spot with me, my friend. That still agonizes me. I was really sorry to miss that one. I saw him last summer, and yeah, he plays for 3 hours. He does 40 songs or something like that. He ends by doing side two of Abbey Road all the way through. And you just think, you know, he could phone it in, but, you know, he's 75. He's still full of energy, full of enthusiasm, because he just loves doing this. And he's so passionate about this music. And it's really contagious, and it's really fun to see its impact on an audience with all different generations and all different age groups and all different cultures and all different personality types, just everybody coming together for Paul.
And you talk about your love for Rubber Soul. I love the album. I still think Revolver is the best. And yet I've got a real soft place in my heart for Abbey Road. And maybe it's because of the circumstances around it that they decided to give it one last try to be the band they used to be.
Yeah, there's something really beautiful about that. Of course, you know, for those of us who grew up in the 70s and 80s, we kind of had the narrative in our head that there's Abbey Road and then there's Let It Be as the last album. But it's really moving to think of how, you know, they recorded Let It Be. The sessions were a disaster. Everybody was at each other's throats. And with Abbey Road, they said, let's not go out like that. Let's go out with a great album that's worthy of our shared history. And it's really beautiful that they were able to rally that old team spirit for that.
And you open the book in your prelude with a wonderful story, I think, that sets a great tone. Can you tell the story of that rooftop concert and Paul McCartney's comment to Mo Starr?
I love that at the end of Get Back, you know, they're doing the song on the roof and it ends with, you know, a little bit of laughter from the crew that's there. And John goes into his famous joke. He says, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the band and myself. And I hope we pass the audition. and yet something really easy to overlook is you hear Paul McCartney say, thanks, Mo. And it's really kind of amazing. He's talking to Mo Starr, who is Maureen Starr, who is Ringo's wife. And she is the Beatle wife who was originally a Beatle fan. She was a teenage girl who used to go see them at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. And she, you know, that's how she first met the band. Was she was one of the girls in the audience. The first time she ever talked to Ringo, she was knocking on the window of his car to ask him for an autograph. And that she crossed the line from a fan to a member of the inner circle. But it's really moving to think that it's this confused moment, it's this tense moment, it's this really scary moment, really, for all four Beatles to think about looking at the end of the line. And Paul just sees Maureen Starr clapping, and he remembers why they're doing this. It's really kind of beautiful that, you know, he sees her, somebody who's actually having a good time, who's always been the sort of supportive girl fan who the Beatles have always depended on, and that he makes that moment all about her is really beautiful to me.
The book is called Dreaming the Beatles, the love story of one band and the whole world. Rob Sheffield, I love the book. Just great. And it's been wonderful to have you on the program. I want to tell you, too, and I mentioned it in the introduction, but Love is a Mixtape. Absolutely one of the most moving books I've read.
That's so kind. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Thank you, man.
Well, we appreciate you coming on with us. Hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's Rob Sheffield, Rolling Stone, and the great new book, Dreaming the Beatles, here on Downtown.